Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit.
Print, television, movies, radio and internet. Media affects how we relate to the world and to each other. Media affects what we know and what we buy. It's a major force, and it's our topic today. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. I'm Anne-Marie Roque, sitting in for Sandy Billings, and I'm hosting today's show about the media. I have a collection of encore pieces from 2007 and 2008, recompiled in a brand new way. In this first installment of our show on media, feminist teacher and researcher Cynthia N. Lowe explores why governments encourage women to support their wars. Professor N. Lowe's work has focused on the interplay of women's politics in the national and international arenas, with special attention on how women's emotions and physical labor has been used to support government's war-waging policies, and how many women have tried to resist both of these practices. In the recent years, N. Lowe lectured internationally on feminism, militarization, and globalization. Among her 9 books are Bananas, Beaches and Bases, Making Feminist Sense of International Politics, Maneuvers, The International Politics of Militarizing Women's Lives, and most recently, The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in a New Age of Empire. In a presentation at the University of Idaho, Cynthia N. Lowe talked about how the government depends on women to wage war, and about the impact of war and militarism on women, focusing how women's roles as mothers change when the sons enter the military. She says that mothers of veterans take on the role of an activist. She doesn't just mean the obvious activist that Julia Ward Howe was or that Cynthia Sheehan is today, but that their activity in supporting their sons by default supports the system and governments that wage war. As an example, here's Professor N. Lowe's telling the story of Charlene Kane, a mother who needed to take care of her son Michael when his leg was amputated because of the injuries he received during the Gulf War.
And so Charlene Kane comes to Washington. She helps Michael at least inch his way out of depression to begin to engage with therapy that is going to have to go on for a long time. After a month or so, the Walter Reed Hospital folks, trying to do as best they can, now remember, he's in the ward that has not had the problems. He's not in Building 18. They send him home. Okay, now what? Charlene Kane is essentially the head of a complex household. Added to that household now is a brand new young man who's had his left leg amputated. At the end of her work day, after she's, you know, helped the household get settled, and spending about 2 hours a night on Veterans Administration and Department of the Army forms. Because there's no guarantee that Michael will get the series. He's going to have more operations, and then more operations. He's going to have drug therapy, and then more drug therapy. He's going to have physical therapy, and then more physical therapy. Under which benefit plan will each of those come? That's Charlene Kane's now responsibility. Michael's in no condition to handle reams of paper. And so it's going to be up to Charlene Kane to make sure that Michael gets the years of therapy and medical attention that he can get. The household certainly can't pay for it. It will have to come from one form of either Department of the Army or Veterans Administration. And if you slip between the two, you can be in big trouble. That's where we leave Charlene Kane. But for how many years will she be the activist mother of a veteran? Now, in no part of the story do we get any sense of what Charlene Kane's ideas are about war, about the current administration, about foreign policy, about political change in the Middle East. And again, in that sense, she doesn't come across as political. But is she political? Oh, yes. Because governments cannot wage wars. And I'm talking about all kinds of governments. I'm talking about the government of the Congo. I'm talking about the government of France. I'm talking about the government of Vietnam. I'm talking about every government that either prepares for war or wages war has to have women as mothers who don't think of themselves as political, but just think of themselves trying to be good mothers, carrying the burden of care of soldiers who come home.
In addition to mothers being co-opted into supporting war efforts, Professor Enlow describes how governments target moms when recruiting soldiers. She describes one ad that aired in the afternoons, a prime time to catch a target audience of stay-at-home moms.
The camera is sitting right up close at a kitchen table. A woman is sitting there at the kitchen table, a middle-aged woman, African-American woman, sitting there at the kitchen table, and a young man, quite a handsome young African-American man, maybe 18, 19, walks into the kitchen. And it's all done quite close up. Again, there's no music in the background or anything. And the son says to his mom, who's sitting there, he says, "Mom, I think I figured out how we can do it." And she said, "What do you mean how we can do it?" He said, "We know how we've really been trying to figure out a way for me to go to med school." He says to his mom, "I think I figured out how we can do it. I can enlist in the Army, and they will eventually pay for me going to med school." You have to read the very, very small print. It's like a camel going through an eye of a needle to actually get your full education benefits as a military personnel in 2007 United States. But that is certainly one of the enticements for a lot of people, young people and their parents, for considering enlisting. And he says, no, Mom, you know what? And furthermore, it'll make me a man." And then the ad's over.
Governments recognize how essential it is to gain mothers' support for war, Cynthia Enlow says, indirectly, if not directly. And they apparently are quite successful. This report was compiled by Brittany Perrault, who interned with Yin Radio in 2007. Brittany's now at Fisher Communications in Seattle. Installment number 2 was also prepared by Brittany Perrault during her internship here with Yin Radio. In 2007, Brittany interviewed Eddie Hilliard, a prominent radio executive. Eddie Hilliard has been the CEO of Greenstone Media, a women's radio network, an effort that was backed by big names like Jane Fonda and Gloria Steinem, and it was an effort that failed. It went under shortly after Brittany talked to Eddie. Although Eddie has already left her post, Brittany asked Eddie about Greenstone Media. And about who's tuning in to radio, who's tuning out, and what messages are being sent.
What I wanted to talk about is the importance of radio in general, with, you know, the internet and the television and iPod, you know, podcasts and things like that. What's your opinion on the significance compared to, you know, competing with the modern media styles today?
I think it's extremely important that we keep radio as the people's medium. It's free. It has the potential of being the, and it's often the first medium turned to in the case of emergency. Its challenge and its obligation is to serve the public interest. I think it's doing a bad job of that now, generally. And I think some things need to change. I'm extremely concerned about the loss of audience that radio is incurring. And they are incurring, especially with the younger audience, women, teens. Women particularly are finding less and less of interest on radio. And there are a lot of reasons for that, I think. Radio is the only medium that doesn't have any kind of meaningful spoken word programming, informational programming for women. Mm-hmm. Unlike television with its Oprah and Ellen and The View and Dr. Phil and all those shows that talk about issues that matter to women. Unlike newspapers, which have whole sections devoted to the interests of women, unlike the 40 or 50 or 60 magazines that are devoted to women, unlike cable and the internet, radio is really the only medium that doesn't play in that arena. Sadly, because women are the most wanted audience for advertisers, for marketers.
Well, I was going to ask also if there was anything you feel could be improved within mainstream radio today. What would you think that would be?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the radio needs to be more local. I think that there need to be more women involved in determining what the formats will be. Unfortunately, the people who control those decisions about what will be programmed on radio stations are almost exclusively male. Almost all the owners of radio stations are male. In fact, only 3.4% of the almost 12,000 radio stations in the United States, AM and FM stations, are owned 50% or more by women. Almost all the general managers are women. Well, I have the exact numbers. It's 15% are women and 85% men. They're the ones that control formats, decisions, changes. The programmers, it's even worse. There's only 9 to 10% of the radio stations in the United States are programmed by women. And as a consequence, women's views, women really don't have a voice on the radio. And one of the reasons there are so few programmers is that there are so few women actually on the air. You really need that on-air experience. So there's no women in the pipeline even coming through from on-air to program director to general manager to regional or owner. So that's really a focus that I'm working on now with some other individuals who have an interest in this and seeing more women get into the pipeline. Of all media, radio should be a reflection of our population. But women don't have a voice. More than half the population don't have a meaningful voice on radio, and neither do other minorities, for that matter, on most stations. The difference with women and with minorities, however, is that at least there are urban stations. There is a company, Radio One, that programs to the African American community and has stations throughout the country and supplies programming to other stations, even non-owned stations that target that community. Hispanic stations have sprung up all over the country. There are two major companies that are playing in that arena, plus program suppliers. There's nothing like that for women. The other voice that's missing in radio is the moderate to liberal voice. The talk stations in the United States are 89% conservative. The ones that are political, 89% conservative, 11% progressive. There's really nothing much in the middle. There are the mainstream news talk stations that are doing quite well in all the major markets. There'll be one. But the interesting thing is the stations that are doing the very best, in fact, the top-rated stations in almost every single major market are the NPR stations. Mm-hmm. And we've seen rapid growth in the NPR audience. There's a corresponding decline in listenership on the commercial side. It's very interesting with women, for example, if you look at the 18 to 34 demo, the audience has declined in the last 7 years on commercial radios. There is 22% less listening in 7 years, less time spent listening, almost as big a cum. Mm-hmm. People tuning in, but they're just not spending as much time because they don't find it satisfying. Right. During that same period, 25% increase in women's listening to NPR. That tells you they're looking for information, they're looking for something they can't get on commercial radio. Mm-hmm. And when you have only music stations, which FM stations are what women listen to, they're only music, they're not getting that kind of information.
That's interesting that you brought that up, because I was going to ask why you, in some of the work that you've done previously, decided to move from not playing music to more of a talk radio sort of thing. So is that why you did that?
Actually, no, I retired.
Oh.
I retired. Well, I ran the first half of my career, I was on the station side, and I was on, for example, at KJR in the late 70s and early 80s, and then I ran King AM, and those were both music stations. But in those days, those big rock radio stations, and there were some in almost every market, most of them were AMs, and we also had very strong news departments, so that you had that mix. You had somebody could listen to a rock and roll radio station, a KJR or a King or a KFRC in San Francisco or WLS, I mean, you name all the big old AM rockers, and get the basic news that you needed to know, what was going on that day, both locally and nationally, and that all changed with DREG. After I was on the station side, I went into the syndication side and supplied programming to radio stations and began programs like Delilah and Leah and some other personality things that we syndicated. I did that. That was a business decision, because there was such an opportunity after consolidation for program suppliers. If you could find talent that would be better than stations could afford locally or even find locally, and make it available to stations for inventory, for minutes every hour, commercial minutes every hour, you could make a lot of money. And that's how we managed to grow the small syndication company that we had into a very large syndication company that then was acquired by a network. But it was still all pretty much music. The industry is so controlled by men who are really pretty convinced that women don't want anything other than music on the radio stations. Pretty convinced that the only talk that will work is hot political talk, either conservative political talk a la Rush Limbaugh, or hot talk a la Howard Stern or Tom Likas, neither of which appeals to women. And the numbers are there. In Arbitron, you can tell women don't listen, don't like the research that we've done. When I left radio in 2003, I just decided there were other things I wanted to do in my life while I was still young enough and healthy enough to do them. There really was no opportunity for any kind of talk that would be different than what was currently being done, the hot talk, the conservative talk. However, things have changed in the last 3 or 4 years in that there is that attrition of music listeners. They're going to the iPod, they're going to the internet, they're going to some wireless radio pretty soon. There's all kinds of places to go for music, and people are going elsewhere for music. And as they go elsewhere for music, the only thing that radio is going to ultimately be able to do that can't be cheaply got anywhere else is talk. Mm-hmm. And if all stations do is transfer that conservative, male-oriented talk from AM to FM, which is where the music is now, but which is losing its audience, they won't have any women listening. And so when I was approached by Gloria Steinem and Jane Fonda and a group of women who, after the 2004 election, got together and started thinking about what could be done, make radio available and interesting and accessible to women, I started looking. I contacted a lot of my contacts in the industry, the friends that I still had at every level, the programmers, the owners, the managers, syndicators, and said, well, what's changed? And the trends have changed because the audience is going away, because people are moving away from music. The general consensus is that talk is moving to FM and that it's, quote, time for female talk. So we developed a product, but I'll tell you, it's the biggest challenge I've ever faced in my radio career, because they are scared. The people who make those, the gatekeepers, all men at every level, from owners to managers to program directors, being so heavily dominated by men, are scared to death of something that isn't proven until we get a major success on a single radio station. When we do, and that'll eventually happen, when we do, it's a lemming business, and it'll happen. But until then, it is a huge, huge challenge to even get them to be serious about it.
That's with almost anything with women. It's interesting to challenge the norm, and it's, you know, they need proof. There has to be some kind of a proof, and until then, you're right. I think that it's not, they aren't going to take us seriously until we can finally prove somehow that.
Well, I'm sure you encounter this in your in women's studies and in the other arenas that you play in. If people think you're a, quote, feminist, the assumption is, or if they think you're in women's studies, or if they think you're advocating for women, whether it's a women's radio format or it's any particular advocating for women, the assumption is that you're against males. And that is such a stupid assumption. And it's such a counterproductive assumption. We have really run into that because, you know, of Gloria Steinem and Jane Fonda's reputations as feminists. But, you know, I am one of those affirmative action babies. In 1975, I was allowed to go into sales because affirmative action required radio stations, which are federally regulated licenses, to allow women into sales and into management. And prior to that, there were almost no women in either sales or management or programming, still true in programming. But once women got into sales, they quickly proved themselves. And within about 10 years, more than half the salespeople were women. It showed that they could do it. And that's what it took then to move into sales management and then that experience into management. So without a Gloria Steinem and a Jane Fonda and what they did in the late 60s and early 70s, I and most other women who are in significant executive careers today would not be where they are.
Wow. I was wondering if maybe you could tell me a little bit more about Greenstone Media, what you would help develop and its success and continuation and challenges.
It's too early a word for it because it's still in a baby stage. And we made the decision, it was about maybe 18 months ago, to move forward and raise money to develop talk programs that could be syndicated to radio stations across the country. Our target was FM radio stations, music stations that were troubled, that were losing their audience. And there, almost every group that has these clusters of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 radio stations in a market has at least one that's underperforming. And based on all of our informal research in the industry, we really believed that that we would be able to penetrate that market more quickly than we have been able to. But once we made the decision to move ahead, the board went out to find money, and I went out. I was hired as the executive vice president, chief operating officer, and asked to find the talent, set up the infrastructure, set up the operation. And I did that. I hired a very small team, basically three people who were experienced in the business, and we went to find talent. And we found some fabulous talent. And one of the shows, we ended up in the first... Well, within 6 months, we had 4 day parts, each 5 days a week, 3 days, 3 hours a day. We since added a weekend show. So we had 63 hours a week of live programming, 2 shows coming out of New York in the morning and 2 coming out of L.A. in the afternoon, and then the weekend show with Nancy Giles and Aaron Moriarty coming out of New York on the weekend. And of the 5 shows that we have, the weekend show is going to do great. They're a wonderful talent team, very experienced, both have television as well as radio experience. But I think the home run that we have hit, it'll take a while for it to reach the bleachers, but is Lisa Birnbach, who is in New York. She is one of the smartest people I've ever met. She's funny. She is probably one of the best interviewers I've ever met, and she knows everybody. I mean, Alec Baldwin is a best friend. She just won a Gracie Award for the best talk show with her interview with Robin Williams. She's knowledgeable. She's smart. She writes for Parade magazine. She's written, you know, all these 1,003 ways to be a friend, 1,003 ways to be a sister, and all those books. So she's going to be a major success. The challenge we faced going out was we had to have enough programming for a station to convert its entire format, because you don't take a female-targeted 3-hour show and stick it in a typical AM conservative talk radio station. And you can't stick it in the middle of the day on a music station. It just, that doesn't work. And so it was very expensive to do. And if I could do it over, I would certainly wish we could do it differently, because it is so expensive to mount that much live programming from offices in New York and L.A. And until you get a critical mass of radio stations airing the programming, you bleed. And that's what, the challenge is. I've moved out of active management. I found my own replacement, Nancy Vaith, who was the president and chief officer of Susquehanna, which was a large group, which last year sold to Cumulus, one of the largest groups. And she's taken over in the day-to-day management. I'm on the board and, you know, working and advising and helping wherever I can.
And I just wanted to close with, what is the extreme importance of women being involved with the media? Why is it so important for women and their voices to be heard?
Well, women are more than half the population, and if their voice isn't being heard, if women don't learn about what's going on, A, in the world, but with other women, with the issues that really matter, I mean, women, you know, primary responsibility for child care, primary responsibility for health care, primary responsibility in many cases for income. 62%, 80% of women are employed in the workforce, 62% I think it is, are the primary wage earners in their households. In radio in particular, and again, that's the industry that I'm most familiar with and most passionate about, we know through our own research, we know intuitively, but we also know through hard research that women really dislike polarizing, angry, confrontative talk. What they do, women talk in stories. Women share experience. Women share feelings. They're really interested in knowing what's going on. Women crave information. Women buy more books than anybody. Women buy all those magazines. They're always there interested in transformation. They're interested in what's happening in other people's lives. They really want to know what's going on with women around the world. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's so important that our media address those things and give women a voice so that the listener has something, someone to identify with, someone whose life view is similar to theirs, that they can share with, that they can learn from. And without it, I think, you know, you started the interview by asking what I think is going to happen with radio, or, you know, is it savable? Unless we figure out how to reach back and touch the lives of the constituencies that make up a democracy, women, moderates, unless we are able to get back and be local and deal with the issues in local in a way that's interesting. It's got to be interesting. It's got to be, it doesn't have to be funny, entertaining. It has to be entertaining that in that it has to be compelling. Mm-hmm. It has to be presented in an articulate way, in a way that people can grasp, understand, and respond to. And if radio can do that, it'll survive. If it doesn't, but you know, it is the voice of the people.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Brittany Perrault brought us that interview with radio executive Eddie Hilliard. That was I Turn My Radio On from Pop Stars. This is Yin Radio, and our topic today is the media. I'm Anmarai Roque, sitting in for Sandy Billings. The Venerable Top Ten Chat Run has been a Buddhist nun for 30 years. She's an American woman who grew up in Western U.S. and was drawn to the Tibetan Buddhism as a young woman. Top Ten founded and leads the Shravasti Abbey in northwestern Washington, has written several books, does interfaith work, and works with prisoners, and gives talks around the world. When Sunny spoke with her in the fall of 2007 at the Sravasti Abbey, she told Sandy about choosing the monastic life. It led to a discussion of the messages we get from family, friends, media, and culture, and how we decide what's really right for yourself. Here's the Buddhist nun, the Venerable Thubten Shatran.
And so I decided that, you know, I wanted to become a monastic in the Tibetan tradition. When I asked my teachers for permission, they said, okay, but wait a while. And they made me wait nearly a year and a half, which was actually very good. And because meanwhile, my family was telling me I was totally nuts. You know, it's like you graduated Phi Beta Kappa, so you could live in Nepal where there aren't even flush toilets. And what are we going to tell our friends? And you have this good education. Why don't you use it to help somebody? As if spiritual practice didn't help anybody. You know, this kind of thing. So I had to really think about all their objections. I had to consider them. And when I did, I still came to the conclusion that what I was doing was, in the long term, going to be the most beneficial.
How hard was that? I mean, maybe you just tried to describe that, but I think many of us struggle with that, going against all those external messages, and it's not just from family.
Yeah, it's family, friends, all of society. Well, but you know, I think what happened is I started really examining those messages and asking myself, you know, I'm getting all these messages, all this conditioning. If I follow the path that these people are saying, does it actually bring the results that they say I'm going to get? So I look, the pervasive message in society, what is it? Make money, get possessions, you'll be happy. I looked around me, I'm living in the richest country on this planet, there are so many people with misery here. And I've lived in a lot of countries, you know, in the world, and this country has much more mental suffering than anywhere else. We don't have as much physical suffering, but much greater mental suffering. Okay? So then I thought, well, these people are giving me all this line about how to be happy. It doesn't bring the result they tell me. Okay? I looked at the message that we had, especially for women. You have to be in a relationship, otherwise you don't have a life. Your life only starts when you're in a relationship and somebody loves you and you're the special one in somebody's life and you have a special one in your life. Otherwise, your life is just kind of on hold. And I was watching how women defined themselves in terms of the men in their lives. You know, and I was brought up, you know, this was supposed to, having a romantic relationship and a family was supposed to bring you everlasting happiness. Okay, and then I looked. All I did is look, you know. My parents, they're still married now. They've been married, they're going to be celebrating their 60th anniversary, which is fantastic. But have they had everlasting bliss? No. My friends, you know, everybody's getting married, everybody's excited, and then after a few years, no. You know, I looked at all sorts of different people who were in all sorts of different relationships. I didn't see anybody who was totally satisfied.
And have you had relationships?
Oh yeah, I was married before I became a nun, and I had many relationships before I got married. Yeah. So I knew also from my own experience, you know, it's like the radio and TV build up this whole thing. But it's all a big lie. And then people are so disappointed afterwards. And I think that's one of the reasons the divorce rate is so high, is because people have all these fantasies about what a romantic relationship is and what it should bring. So, you know, when I started looking at all these things in society, I began to see that they weren't really true, you know, and especially like the conditioning we women get about, and I'm so disappointed now, you know, because when I was young, it was the conditioning was, you have to be gorgeous because your meaning in life is being a sex object. And then I thought with the women's liberation movement and all the strides that came about, that message would change. I can't believe it, you know. Even now, women who are highly educated, who are, you know, doing incredible work, still in the back of the mind, everybody buys into the message that you're only worthwhile if you have a gorgeous body. And that is a dead end, because we're all getting older and uglier. Nobody's getting younger and more beautiful.
Not in that definition of beauty.
Right. I'm talking about physical beauty. Okay. Nobody's getting younger and more physically beautiful. When I go to high school sometimes, the kids, they're always so interested. How come you're wearing those clothes? How come you shave your head? You know. And so I tell them, well, I want to cultivate inner beauty. I don't care so much about external beauty. And if somebody's going to like me, if somebody's going to care about me, it's going to have to be because of inner beauty, not because of external beauty. And you can see these teenagers, especially the girls, their jaws are just hanging open like, how can you think like that? You know, they've never heard that they can be a worthwhile human being even if they're not beautiful. And I think that's so horrible for young women. And just the fact now that even like 8 and 9 year old girls are getting so sexualized. I mean, they aren't even a sex... Well, this is going to make them into sex objects. I mean, our society is so screwed up. On one hand, we're like all out to get the pedophiles. On the other hand, we're teaching the 6-year-olds how to look like sex objects. Huh? Excuse me? So, you know, when you really start checking the messages that you're getting from other people, or when I did, I saw that most of them, the people meant well, but they were misinformed. And so when you see that clearly with your own wisdom eye, then if you want to believe in something different, it's okay. You don't worry about whether people like you or don't like you, approve of you or don't approve of you, because you know that what you believe in makes sense. You know, and if you go through your life always trying to fit in and believe what you think they think you should think and be what you think they think you should be, what kind of life is that?
I also find a need to constantly remind myself of what I think. Because if I don't take those quiet times, meditation perhaps, if I don't take those quiet times to know my own voice, I don't hear it above those external voices, whether they be my family, my friends, or the radio and television, magazines.
Right. And that quiet time is so important. And yet, what do? We are so afraid of being alone. We don't know the difference between being alone and being lonely. We think they're the same. They're not the same. And so people, you know, they come in their house, they turn on the radio, they turn on the TV, turn on anything to distract themselves from being alone. So they get more of those messages, buy into more of those messages, and they give away their own power and they give away their own quiet time. And that's why I think it's so important, you know, to really distance ourselves somewhat from the media so we can hear our own voice and figure out what we really believe in. Because otherwise we all become automatons.
Sandy Billings conducted that interview with Buddhist nun Tetran Chapten. In the first season of Yin Radio, Sandy talked to Rita Henley Jensen, the creator and editor-in-chief of Women's eNews. It's an internet-based news service focusing on news about women and issues that impact women. And it's international. Rita told Sandy about why she started Women's eNews.
Women's eNews, it's the definitive source of substantive news. It's unavailable anywhere else, and it covers issues of particular concern to women and providing women's perspectives on public policy. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Rita Henley Jensen, the founder and editor-in-chief of Women's eNews. Are you there, Rita?
Join you today. This is fantastic.
Great. Thank you. I'm so glad to have you. Let me just briefly introduce you, Rita, that you were named by the New York Daily News as one of the 100 most influential women in New York. You're a former senior writer for the National Law Journal and columnist for the New York Times Syndicate. Rita has more than 20 years of experience in journalism and journalism education, as well as an armload of awards. And I could list a lot, number of those. I might do that afterward. Also in Rita's bio, she says she's a survivor of domestic violence and a former welfare mother. She earned degrees from Ohio State University and Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, and she's the grandmother of two granddaughters and two grandsons.
Yes, we try to be very balanced.
That's just luck of the draw, we know that. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what is different about women's e-news from other major media news?
Well, I think one of the first things you want to look at is that we do not accept advertising. We're advertising free. And not only does that mean that you're not bothered with pop-ups, but historically, advertisers have set the editorial agenda of publications directed toward women. And that has, we believe, really handicapped women's ability to know what's going on with their lives in the city council, in the planning commission, at the state legislature, or the Supreme Court, White House, Congress level. And we feel that it was a huge gap, and it was our obligation, an opportunity, really, to provide women the information they need.
You also hire exclusively or use exclusively women reporters?
We do not use women reporters exclusively.
Oh, okay.
Because that would be discrimination. I don't believe in that. No, we do have male reporters. And in fact, the first story we published on June 15th, 2000, was a story written by a man about how police departments underreport rape.
Oh. Thanks. Maybe I should start by asking you for a little brief history of women's e-news since I made some of those errors there.
Well, you know, I'd like to talk about why I created it.
Yes.
I was a senior writer at the National Law Journal. I was on a mid-career fellowship, which, as we all know, gives people some chance to think. That's what you're supposed to do. And at that time, Newt Gingrich was reelected to the, and the Republicans took over Congress. This was 94. And as part of that, they promised to end welfare. Now, as a former welfare mother, a survivor of domestic violence, and those two things are closely related, as most of us know, I hope, I was stunned. I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible for women. And when I read the newspaper coverage about this, a huge initiative that everybody still thinks is a wonderful idea, and it has some merits, but what I didn't see in any of the news coverage was a focus on how then would single mothers be able to take care of their children. And that's still the unanswered question. But the coverage was just so bad that I was ashamed, because it was one issue I really knew affected women, affected low-income women, affected women who were raising children on their own, and I just didn't see them represented at all in the discussion. And out of that, I decided that I had to change journalism and just find a way for it and to guide it to do perhaps a better job. And it took a long time. Finally, as I said, a nonprofit hired me to create an internet news service covering issues of particular concern to women. And my first decision, this was in 99, so it was pretty early. My first decision was that it would have to be daily. And I had been struggling so long that I had an incredible network of other journalists who, would be willing to freelance for us. And so we set out there on June 15th of 2000 to publish every single day, which we have, including on 9/11. And we are based in New York City. We didn't publish much on 9/11, I have to say. It was just a brief message. But nevertheless, every single day. And it's been fantastic. And then we went out on our own as an independent in 2002. And as a journalist, I had never had to raise money. And somebody had this budget staring me in the face. So that was a skill that I'm still learning. And but so far, we've muddled through, lucked through, we've been able to manage, and as you know, we've won 24 journalism awards over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this incredible audience of people who really, you know, are very active in women's organizations, trying to improve women's lives, members of Congress, other people in other media outlets. We get email messages from Nigeria, from Rwanda, from Lebanon, from Kyrgyzstan, from Chile. From Australia. We're global, and I cannot tell you how exciting it is for somebody out of the newspaper industry, which is by definition local, to, you know, create something that reaches women worldwide.
But you also, when you were describing how you thought of this, you were wanting to change journalism. Now, that's a pretty big job you've given yourself. And yet,
I don't know what I was thinking.
You were thinking, but it looks like you've done it, at least to a large extent. Maybe there's room for growth, but nonetheless, you have made a big impact. Were you daunted at all in biting off that big a chunk, or did you see the smaller pieces first?
I was just so compelled. I love journalism. I was a prize-winning investigative reporter. I was so committed to my profession and the ideals of my profession, which I guess I would describe as, you know, being the handmaiden of people to be active citizens. If the citizens don't have the information, again, they can't go to city council, they can't go to the planning board, they can't go to the school board and say, hey, if they don't know what's going on. So historically, news media and journalism is supposed to be the handmaiden of citizens. And I felt that women, female citizens, were being shortchanged by news media.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so, such a profound issue for me that even it's that huge task, it's just like I didn't have any choice. I was just compelled to do it.
Yeah, sounds like you definitely found your calling then as you found that.
I did.
What kind of risks or challenges did you have to take to get it going and to stay motivated?
I have no problem staying motivated. I go to a lot of meetings and conferences et cetera, to learn more, and I'm always learning, which is another reason why I love my profession and love the news business. Is, you know, people are constantly surprising you, and there's lots of new information out there, so I have no problem being motivated. The biggest challenge, again, is fundraising. Everybody knows that women don't support other women. Everybody knows that internet readers do not support internet sites. Everybody knows these, you know, whatever. And somebody who had no background in fundraising, and as a former welfare mother, I didn't really have an extensive family network or those kinds of resources that people often have. Luckily for me, I went to Columbia Graduate School,
mm-hmm.
and, which was, as you know, an Ivy League school, and I did know one person out of my graduating class who offered to help me get started. So I still, if you have a chance, go to an Ivy League graduate school. You meet people who may help you 25 years do something later, do something you really feel you have to do.
Yeah.
And then learning how to raise money. And as I said, that's a craft. We are now, March 1, we are starting a campaign on our website called We Make Internet History. And that's the kind of history we want to make. One, we're making internet history because we've lasted this long, and we're an independent news site, which is almost unheard of. But also, we want our readers to support us and to help us make internet history in that our readers support us.
Mm-hmm.
So we're optimistic about that. It's just something that I have to constantly work at, and doesn't come natural to me, but I am so compelled that this continue. I think it is so important.
Yeah, and that, I think that's the key. If you're compelled to do it, you can learn the skills you need to make things happen.
And other people want to help you. I mean, that's what the most beautiful thing about learning how to raise money is the incredible people you meet, you know, who really do care and will either write the check or know or try to help you find people who will write the check. And that's whether they're in foundations or it's their personal money. They're just, the people I've met have just been thrilling. And that when you're a journalist, you're sort of meeting, you know, the people in charge and people, you know, politicians and things like that, and people like that. And so it's a different group of people who have really big hearts and really care about the well-being of others. And that's very exciting.
Yeah.
That's something I did not expect.
Just a little background, as a fundraiser myself, and I, that's the area I was in, was the fundraiser, the hired fundraiser. I have seen that people do come forward. It's about your passion for the cause. And I imagine that whenever we find our passionate cause that we want to pursue, we have to raise funds for it, whether it's on the nonprofit side and getting the donation, or whether it's money for your business. You got to have investment money.
And the studies are that women have difficulty raising venture capital. Women have trouble raising funds for nonprofits. And we all know the statistics about women in poverty. So money is a huge issue. Mm-hmm. You know, we 75 cents on the dollar is what we earn in the marketplace. There are some exceptions, etc. So money is a huge issue for us. It touches so many aspects of our lives, our feeling of self-esteem. Can we take care of our families? Can we add to the economy? Can we save money for our retirement? Can we pay for the medical care we need? Can we do our passion, whether it's a nonprofit or for-profit venture? Can we support the candidate of our choice, and then in a way that we can ensure that we will be heard after the election? It touches every aspect of our lives, and it's been a real education for me.
Well, I very much appreciate you spending a few minutes with us this morning to talk about that passion. I do want to let you know that we have been very grateful and made great use of your news service on my show, on Yin Radio, which is, of course, a show by and about women and men who love them. We don't discriminate either. And we just really rely on that service. So we thank you very much. And I'm so glad you found your passion, and it's making a difference.
Thank you so much.
That was Rita Henley Jensen, Editor-in-Chief of Women's E-News, speaking with Sandy via phone in March 2007. You can find Women's E-News at www.womensenews.org. And one thing you'll find there is a podcast of their weekly news summary, prepared by Yin Radio each week and read by yours truly. That wraps up today's Yin Radio show on the theme Media. I'll leave you with this piece by the musical group Tyrette. It's called Listen.
I'll tell you who you are. call them home. Creatures crawling on the ground, beehive, busy buzzing sound, and hills hailing to the queen, empires towering over trees.
If you want to hear past shows or podcasts of the show, you can do that at yinradio.org. And that's where you can sign up for our electronic newsletter to find out what's going on with Yin Radio. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. Let us know what you think of Yin Radio for good or bad. What would you like to hear more of or less of on the show? What are we missing that needs to be covered? Drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio@v as in voice, p as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and heard on The Detour, the voice of Appalachia, at thedetour.us, and 105.3 FM in Johnson City, Tennessee, and on other stations around the country. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. The executive producer is Sandy Billings. I'm Anne-Marie Roque. I'm glad you joined me. Until next week.